A lot of times a question comes up with what David did in regard to being unfaithful to God and the sins that he committed. And in the way they compare with Saul's, then why is David blessed and why is Saul having the kingdom taken from him? I think you'll get a little bit of an answer to that as we look at some things tonight and talk about some things in connection with Saul. We'll be in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 14 and chapter 15 tonight. And if you'll take your Bibles and open there, we will start there momentarily. I may not mention everyone that you talk about, but if you go speak up loud enough, and if I hear, I'll try to repeat. If you have any prayer requests that you would like for us to make mention of before we begin our class tonight. All is good. Okay. I will tell you, Mickey Alford had shoulder surgery this morning and went home, and we'll start rehab tomorrow morning at 11. So, but everything went well with his surgery, and be with him in his recovery. And you probably also already received the calling post that Violet Townsend's brother passed away. And that visitation will be Friday morning at 10, followed by the funeral at 11 in Scottsboro. If you are wondering, we haven't got anyone arranged to drive a bus. I know that I can't, and I know that no one in the office can. And so far, we haven't, as far as I know, we haven't had anyone express any interest in it. But right now, it doesn't look as if a bus will be able to go. Yes. Right. Talking to Mark. Okay to mention? Too late if it isn't. But, yeah. Matt's having MRI tomorrow. I want to be in prayer for that, that MRI will come out clear and that everything will be fine. But keep the snows in your prayer. In your prayers, especially Matt. He has that tomorrow. Okay, let's bow together. Father, we thank you so much for our day today. We thank you for loving us and the blessings you give to us. We thank you for your holy word, and we ask you to help us to understand it and see the things that you want us to know about ourselves and about you and about how you would have us to be. We ask you to be with us as we go through our class tonight. We ask you to be with Matt tomorrow in the MRI and help everything to be clear for him. And we ask you to be with him and help him throughout this whole procedure. We ask you to be with Violet and her family. And we ask you to be with Mickey and his family and all the others that are recovering from surgeries and the surgeries that might be upcoming. Thank you for loving us, and thank you for the hope we have in Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen. I want to show you on the map. We're going to be looking at the battle that is started by Jonathan in chapter 14 against the Philistines. And very interesting, and there's a comparison given to us in the thinking of Jonathan and in the thinking of Saul. And it continues this contrast between not only Saul and his son Jonathan, but especially Saul and David, who's going to be the next king. And really a contrast between an individual who has genuine trust in God and an individual who doesn't. And Saul being the one who doesn't. Where the Philistines are is at this place called Michmash. And you can't really see that on this white screen, but I wanted you to know where it was. There's debate whether what the text says is that Saul was at Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, and he was there with 600 men. And from there, evidently, they didn't have to go very far to be able to see what was happening over at Michmash where the Philistines were. And there's some that think his spies may have gone to Geba and were able from there to look at Michmash. But at Michmash, the Philistines were on top of the mountain. And there were some valleys or ravines or whatever you want to call them that Solomon and his armor bearer had to go through or to cross through in order to be able to get over to Michmash and then climb the cliff to be able to go up to where the Philistines are. And this map is harder to see. It's hard to read the names, but here's Michmash. Can you see these valleys? And you look how deep they are. And I couldn't get in close enough on the satellite image. This Bible program also has a satellite image of the maps. And it was going to take me a while to figure out how to work that, so I decided to just go with this one. But you can see these, not sure which one of the ridges that the Philistines were on, but it could be either one of these things, these valleys here that Solomon and his armor bearer climbed up. Now, in chapter 15, we're going into the story of Saul being told to go and destroy the Amalekites. And the Amalekites are south. They're down here in what's called the Negev, which is the south. It's a desert area. And we'll say more about the Amalekites when we get there, but they're down below what we're looking at here, really down below the Dead Sea. And I'll leave that map up there, and you can take a look at it when we run across a name or something, and you want to see it. So the end of chapter 13, a detachment of the Philistines had come to Michmash, and they think it might have been the heart of the entire army, but they were scattered out in different places, and Jonathan is not going to run headlong into the entire army, but he's going to have enough on his hands. Remember now, how many swords are there among Israel? Two. Saul has one and Jonathan has one. And those are the only two swords there. So I think it's kind of funny. This armor bearer could be his squire, or it could be an armor bearer. But if it's his armor bearer, he doesn't have a whole lot to carry. And so he's not going to be hindered a whole lot. But it's going to be some interesting things said that just takes common sense to figure out how they take place. So one day, Jonathan, who was the son of Saul, said to his armor bearer, "Let's go over to the Philistines. Let's go over to their outpost on the other side." But he didn't tell his father that he was going. So if he was with his father at Gibeah, they leave Gibeah and they make their way up to Michmash. I think it may be about 5 or 6 miles, something of that kind. Maybe not even quite that far. And they go over there to where they are. Saul was staying at the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron, and with him were about 600 men. And it's sort of a phrasing like different judges sitting under a different type of tree. And so here's the king and now ruling over the land. And where he's sitting is under a tree to have shade. And he's got his 600 men with him. With him also was a priest by the name of Ahijah. And if you look in verse 3, Ahijah was Ichabod's brother. and he was the son of Rechab, who was the brother of Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli. And so here's a descendant of Eli that is a priest. But from the prophecy that God made toward Eli, he's not going to be a priest very long. And but he's the one that's there, and he's wearing an ephod, kind of like a vest. And it may have like a pocket. And we'll get into the reason for that in just a second. But it's important, significant for the story, especially regarding Saul, that we understand that Ahitub was there and he has the ephod with him. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistines' outpost was a cliff. He wanted to go through this pass. Each side of it was a cliff. One was called Bozez, and the other one was called Sina. One cliff stood to the north toward Michmash, and the other to the south toward Geba. Can we figure that out? I don't know if we can. Here's Michmash, right here. One stood to the north. Could it be this one? That'd be a cliff there. And here's another cliff. One stood to the south. I don't know if that's what it's talking about or not. Tell you the truth, we might could even have some doubt about is that exactly where Michmash was. But that's what our map indicates for us right now. But there's two cliffs on either side of this pass that he's going through. And Jonathan said to his younger armor bearer, let's go over and let them see us. Let's walk out in the open and not hide ourselves. And let's let those Philistines take a look at us, those uncircumcised men. Let's let them take a look at us and see if the Lord will act in our behalf. Because nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether it be by many or by few. And even though it's just us, two of us, God can cause just the two of us to save. You see a contrast between Jonathan's thinking and Saul's thinking? So what did Saul want to do when his men came face to face with how large the army of the Philistines were, and they were all terrified, and they all started leaving? What did Saul want to do? Offer the sacrifices. I want you to think about why. Because it's going to become key through these next two chapters. I think he was offering the sacrifices to get God obligated. To get God obligated to him. Thinking that I do this and God will bless me. And that's what he's doing with regard to offering those sacrifices. And he's doing that so that he will receive God's blessing to go into the battle and they can be victorious. There's no sacrifice offered here. There's just a man that trusts God. I ran across a phrase in studying this that I thought was spot on with regard to these two chapters. So I want to give it to you. And I want you to think about it from these two chapters. And then I want us, we're not going to do it openly, but I want all of us to be thinking about it with regard to ourselves as we go through this story regarding Saul and Jonathan. And the phrase was this: Saul was stubbornly religious. Jonathan was practically God-fearing. So here is a man, Saul, who is stubbornly religious, almost using religion as if it's a superstition. If I do these things, what things do I have to do in order for God to give me the things that I really need and I really want? And that's Saul, stubbornly religious. On the other side, you have Jonathan, who was a practical man, but God-fearing. So you have a practical man who is absolutely God-fearing. And I thought that was a pretty good description of these two men as we go into it. You see an example of it here with Jonathan. God will save no matter how many we are. I can go by myself if you don't want to go. Because God saves, and it doesn't matter how many. It doesn't matter if we have a big army or not. If God is with us, we can't lose. Who does that remind you of? David. You mean you guys are sitting here listening to this giant and he's challenging the God of Israel? There's no way he can win. And that's, I think, why Jonathan's heart and David's heart was knit so close to each other so quickly, and why they became the friends that they did and became as close as they did. But we go on. So Jonathan tells his armor bearer, come on, we'll go over where they can see us. And here's what we'll do. When they see us, if they say to us, wait where you are, we'll come to you. Then we won't go to them. We'll stay where we are. But if they say to us, come up here, we're going to show you something. Or really, it's come up here where we are. Jonathan says, if they say that, then that is our indication from God that he is with us. And we will go up to them. And God will deliver them into our hands. So they walk out where all the Philistines can see them. And lo and behold, the Philistines say, come up to us. Wait a second. I'm not there yet. Verse 11. When the Philistines saw them, they said, look, those Hebrews are crawling out of the caves they've been hiding in. And the men on the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come on up to us. We'll teach you a lesson. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. They are ours. So Jonathan climbed up using his hands and his feet, his armor bearer right behind him. And the Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. How could his armor bearer follow Jonathan and kill behind him? He picked up a sword. The first one Jonathan slew, got his sword. I think both of them may have gone double-handed, depending on how heavy they were. But as soon as the first one fell, then the armor bearer had a sword and probably had more than one. And he walks behind Jonathan, and Jonathan is killing or wounding, and he's killing behind him. And the Bible says that they kill about 20 men. And they kill about 20 men within an area of about half an acre. Literally, it is one yoke. About how far one oxen would plow, I guess it was in a day. But they considered it about half of an acre, is what the NIV will say. And they did that, and what happened? God caused the ground to shake. And I don't know if that's in a figurative sense or not. What I envision is that God caused an earthquake. And being able to see that two men had killed 20 men in a short space of time, and then the ground shaking, the Philistines went into panic. And when they went into panic, they started fighting each other. And they started killing each other. And Saul, where he was, saw the army of the Philistines just going helter-skelter. Running in, running out, just absolutely in chaos. Not knowing what to do and fighting against themselves. And so this is where this gets interesting and a little bit confusing. confusing. And I'm going to try to tell you what I think it's saying, but I tell you, there's a lot of difference in these next several verses between the Hebrew text and the Septuagint, the Greek text. There's some differences between the two texts, and they're really not so certain the Hebrew text is as good as it is in other places in this particular context. And you'll see what I mean as we go through. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah in Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. That's the army of the Philistines. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who's left us. Somebody's fighting the Philistines. Get everybody together, all 600 of us, and see who it is that's not with us." So they did that, and when they did, they found out Jonathan and his armor bearer were gone. And Saul said to Ahag, the priest, "Bring the ark of God." Well, it says in parentheses, at that time, it was with the Israelites. The ark of God, the ark of God was here. Kiriath-Jearim, that's where it's been since it came back from the Philistines, and that's where it's going to stay until David brings it to Jerusalem. But this parenthesis says that they had brought it close to Gibeah. Either that, or Saul is telling the priest, go to Kiriath-Jearim and get the ark and bring it here. Or, so I don't know what the parenthesis means. I don't know if it means that it's a very recent writer and the ark was there with the Israelites now and no longer with the Philistines. Or if the parenthesis is indicating that the ark had been brought to where the Israelites were and was very near to Saul. And to throw the matter even worse, the Septuagint doesn't say, bring the ark of God. The Septuagint says, bring the ephod, which Ahijah was wearing. They never used the ark to inquire of God. When they wanted to inquire of God, they always used the ephod, never the ark. And so it doesn't make sense that he's wanting to get information about this battle and he's asking for the ark, unless he's wanting the ark to go with them to guarantee God's presence in the battle. And that was what they did when they were in the first battle with the Philistines. And that may have been what was going on here. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So he said to the priest, withdraw your hand. So as Saul is telling the priest, bring the ephod or go get the ark, he then sees that all this chaos with the Philistines is getting worse by the minute. And so he says to the priest, never mind. Withdraw your hand. And it may very well have been that the priest was about to put his hand in the ephod. Now, inside of that ephod where he would put his hand were two stones. They were called the Urim and the Thummim. And all indications are that the two stones were evidently identical by touch, that the priest could put his hand in and he could not select one by feel, because they would feel the same. But they were different in color. One would be light or bright, and the other would be dark. And he pulled out one would be the Urim and one would be the Thummim. And this is going to become very clear toward the end of the chapter when we get to talking about who's guilty of wrongdoing, and they do the Urim and the Thummim, and it comes down to Jonathan. And Jonathan is the one identified by God as the one who had done wrong. are the one who had sinned. And that becomes very clear then. But this may be what he was about to do now. Lord, shall we go up and fight them? Urim and Thummim. Urim will go, Thummim we won't. And when he sees how chaotic everything has gotten, he turns to the priest after he's told him, either bring the ephod or go get the ark. He says to him, withdraw your hand. Never mind. And we're going to go fight. And so they take off in order to fight against them. Where am I? I'm lost. Okay, verse 20. So Saul and his men assembled and they went to the battle and they found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. They were killing each other. And those Hebrews, this gets me. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Why were the Jews, some of them, with the Philistines? They wanted to be with a winning team. It was obvious by how many men Saul had and how many men the Philistines had that this battle is going to go to the Philistines and we don't want to be any part of losing. So they went to the Philistines. Well, guess what? Right before their eyes, they're watching Philistines kill each other. And then they see what Jonathan's done and then they see, here comes Saul. And it doesn't matter how many men he's got because the Philistines are now his own army because they're fighting against each other. And so they come back to the Jews. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So that on the day the Lord saved Israel and the battle moved on beyond Beth-Aven. Now, the Israelites were in distress that day. And the reason they were in distress is because as they were coming to the battle, Saul had shouted out a command and a curse. Cursed be anybody who eats food before evening. And before I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the food, none of the troops tasted food. What's wrong with Saul's statement here at the end? Look, I have avenged, and I have avenged who? My enemies. And it contrasts with verse 23. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on beyond Beth-Aven. And it was the Lord's victory and the Lord's battle. And Saul's not seeing that. He's not even the one that got it started. His son Jonathan did. But he gave orders that they were not to eat anything until evening. You see how a fast worked? A fast in Islam is from morning, morning of dawn till sunset. So you just don't eat from sunrise to sunset. But you can eat all you want at night. But you don't eat from sunrise to sunset. And that's what Saul had said here. Nobody eats until evening. And that's the command that he had given, and he gave a curse. Interesting statement that was made. Joshua made a similar curse. Destroyed the city of Jericho, Joshua said, cursed be the man who rebuilds this city. And the curse was going to be on the day he laid the foundation, one of his sons would die. And on the day he hung the gates, the other one would die. And the story was given to us about the man that did that. But Joshua gave the same kind of a curse. There's no blessing with it, it's just a curse. And Saul gives one. Cursed is any man that eats before the evening. And I haven't checked it out, but one of the things I was reading said this is the last such curse in all of the Old Testament. and that Saul was the last one to offer a curse like this in the Old Testament. And I'm not sure if that's right or not, but it was an interesting thing to think about and be an interesting thing to look at. So the entire army entered the woods or entered the forest. And when they entered the woods, y'all ever seen this? And it's a little bit, there's a little struggle with exactly what is meant here. When they walked into the forest, into the woods, this says honey was oozing out of the ground. They don't know if the words are to indicate that it was oozing out of the ground, or when they came into the woods, they were surrounded by beehives in the trees and other places, and the honey was all over the place. And all the other soldiers saw it, but they didn't do anything. Jonathan sees it, and Jonathan is getting weak because he hasn't had anything to eat either. And he walks over and takes his staff and sticks it into the honey and pulls out possibly a honeycomb, and he eats and his face is refreshed. And he looks at the rest of the men and says, "Why don't you eat?" And they said, "We can't. Your father has issued a command that nobody is to eat until the evening." What does Jonathan say about his dad? This is interesting. It's in verse 29. "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey? How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?" The Israelites were so hungry that after a while, close to evening, they took the plunder, the animals that they had taken, and they slaughtered them on the ground and began to eat them right there without any of the blood being drained from them. And they ate them raw, and they ate them with the blood still in them. Word came back to Saul what the men were doing, and he said, "Tell them to bring all the animals to me." And he had them to kill them on a rock so that they could drain the blood, and evidently then to have fires prepared to be able to cook, and told the men to eat the food that they had taken, but not to eat it with the blood still in it, because that would be a violation of what God had commanded. And so that's what they did. And when they did that, it was night. So the curse was only till the evening, and it was past the evening. And so now they were able to eat. So as soon as the men had eaten, Saul said, "Let's go down and pursue the Philistines by night, and let's plunder them. Let's catch up with these guys and let's get rid of them." And all the men said, "Do whatever seems best to you." The priest said, "Let's ask God." So Saul asked God, Urim and Thummim, "Shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" This is where it gets interesting about my interpretation of the Urim and Thummim. There was no answer given. So what prevented the priest from pulling a rock out? I don't know. And I don't understand. But there's no answer given. And it may have been the Spirit of God that would direct the priest as to which one to pull. I don't know. But anyway, no answer was given. And no answer given meant God's not happy. No answer given meant God is upset. And they knew that. So Saul had everybody together around him, and he wants to know who's committed sin today. Why is the Lord angry with us? Whoever has done it is going to die, even if it's my son Jonathan. None of the men say a word. They all knew what had happened. Saul then said to all Israel, "You stand over there. Jonathan, my son, will stand over here." They said, "You do what seems best to you." That's their only word. That's their favorite phrase. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Why have you not answered your servant? If the fault is me or my son Jonathan, respond with Urim. But if the men of Israel are at fault, respond with famine." Jonathan and Saul were taken by the lot. Famine came out. And the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son." And they did, and Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you've done." So Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I'm going to die." And Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, the one who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives." That's the same oath that Saul had used. "As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. For he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. How do you make sense of that? Okay, it's going to get even more so. It's that way now. But again, you come back to that phrase. Saul, stubbornly religious. And Jonathan, practically God-fearing. Jonathan, I mean, Saul makes up these rules and thinks that he has to keep them because he has set them, and therefore God is going to hold them, everybody, to account for them. And his own son Jonathan didn't know about it and didn't pay any attention to it. And when he found out about it, said, "My dad, he has hurt our country. And he's hurt our army." You wonder what kind of relationship these two men had with each other. Because this doesn't stop here. It goes on. Even into the time when David is there. And all of this, with regard to Saul, might seem confusing now until we see it full blown in chapter 15. And what he's doing here is the same thing he's going to do in chapter 15. And we really get a sense of his attitude toward God and his attitude toward himself. And here it is. He never inquired of God about going to the battle. He never inquired of God about, is it okay for the men to eat? Well, but sure it was. Practically, men are hungry. Let them eat. And that's going to be the way the practical king is going to rule. But he made a rule. And he elevated his rule to the level of God himself. And then he finds out that his own men are rebelling against him. "We will not follow your rule." And they don't. And Jonathan is not killed. What do you think is going on there? Lot had a, they cast a lot, and it came toward Jonathan. I think what's happening there is God in heaven is saying, "You fool who hasn't thought a thing about what you're saying, do you not even know who it is that violated your rule? Do you not know who it is you have sentenced to death? You fool." And I think that's what he's being shown to be, a fool. God doesn't strike Jonathan dead. But he indicates he's the one that sinned, but he didn't sin against God. He sinned against his father. And his father is elevating his commands to the level of God. Because that's where he's elevated himself. He's elevated himself to the level of God. I think that's the way it is. There's no indication here at all of God's anger toward Jonathan. As a matter of fact, everything about this story indicates God's pleasure with Jonathan. God is with us. Let's go up. And they were absolutely victorious. And then God turns this whole battle in favor of Jonathan and in favor of the Israelites. Everything. That's what the men saw. The men saw, you're telling us that this man has sinned when God has blessed him with leading this battle and giving us this great victory? And it's a man who's in the process of going crazy. And he really does when he can't get rid of David. He really does have a God complex. That whatever he says, whatever he wants, he can manipulate God to get. And that may not come out so true here, but it is a little bit. Whoever eats any food before evening is going to die. Really, where's this coming from? It's coming from himself. Okay. So Saul's sons in the last part were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. I don't know if those names are correct. I feel pretty good about Jonathan. I don't feel really good about the rest of them. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of the younger was Michal, who's going to become a thorn in the side of David. His wife's name was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, son of Ner. And Ner was Saul's uncle. So the commander of his army, Abner, was what relation to Saul? Huh? Cousin. It's his cousin. And Saul's father, Kish, and Abner's father, Ner, were sons of Abiel. All the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines, and whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. Samuel comes to Saul. Samuel, we haven't seen for a little while. Samuel comes to Saul. We'll try to go through this quick. I'm the one that the Lord sent to anoint you as king, and now the Lord has a job that he wants you to do. He wants you to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. If you remember back in the book of Exodus chapter 17, children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. And before they got to Mount Sinai, they were attacked by the Amalekites. Because the Amalekites are on the south. They're down toward Mount Sinai. And that's the battle where whenever Moses went up on top of the mountain, he held up his arms, Israel was victorious. Whenever he lowered his arms, then the Amalekites became victorious. And so Aaron and Hur were up with Moses, and they set him down on a stone, and they held up his arms until Joshua and the army were victorious. That was the Amalekites. It's in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 25 that God gives us more detail about that battle. That when the Amalekites attacked, they attacked Israel from the rear, and they killed the stragglers. Who would have been the people too old, too sick, too weak, too feeble to be able to keep up with everybody else? And so the Amalekites attacked them. And that's when they turned and they, to protect everybody at the rear, they had this battle with the Amalekites. And God tells Moses, I'm going to destroy them. And so now, after having waited, God comes to Saul, comes to Samuel first, and he tells Saul, go destroy them. Because of what they did to you when you came out of the land of Egypt, you go destroy them. I don't want any human being left alive. I don't want any animal left alive. I want you to kill every man, every woman, every child. And I want you to kill every animal that they have. That was the order given by God. So while that creates a great deal of hardship for us, we weren't there to see it. We weren't there to see how things went in connection with the Amalekites. And the Israelites, they had constant battles. There's more battles than this one that is made reference to. But bottom line, what you have is the judge of all humanity has passed judgment. And Israel is the executioner of that judgment. In particular, Saul and his army is the executioner of that judgment. I really think, because Saul will say, I listened to the men. And the Bible will say it was Saul and the men with him. I really think the thing became very distasteful to the men. And they didn't want to do it anymore. And I think Saul, thinking about being a king and how other kings treat each other, wanted to give the same honor to Agag. But that wasn't their decision. That wasn't their choice. Because the judge of all humanity had passed judgment on this particular group of people. And their job was to be the executioner for the judge of all humanity. How do you think it's going to be in the last day to those when God says, depart from me. I never knew you. And we will have no voice to say, no, don't do that. That's not fair. No one will. And so here we have an example of it, I think. And so here we go. So Saul summoned the men. They went down south. When they get down south, they run into a group of people known as the Kenites. And they tell the Kenites, get out of here. You were kind to us. You treated us well. We don't want to harm you. So don't be anywhere around when we come against the Amalekites. You get out. And all the Kenites got out. Who are the Kenites? Right. Moses' father-in-law's people. What did they do for the children of Israel? They became guides to lead them to where the water was. Because they were living in the south where the Israelites were wandering. And it was Moses' father-in-law that were the Kenites, and they helped Israel. They still lived among the Israelites. And as a matter of fact, in the book of Jeremiah, there's a group of people that don't drink wine. And God tells Jeremiah, you go make these Rephaites drink wine. They refuse. We will not drink wine because our forefathers told us not to drink wine and not to live in the city. We have never drank wine and we will not start now. And then God told Jeremiah, look at these people. They obey their forefather. And I can't get Israel to obey me. And he used the Rephaites as an example. The Rephaites were Kenites. They were descendants of a particular man who was a Kenite. And so they were the same group of people. They are spoke well of all through the Bible. So the Kenites get out, and Saul and his army attack the Amalekites. They attack them, and they destroy everybody but Agag and the very best of the sheep and the cattle, whether young or old. Everything that was good, they kept. And they start on their way back. God sends a message to Samuel and says, I'm sorry I ever made the man king. Because he's turned away from me and he fails to carry out my instructions. And Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, he got up to go meet Saul, but Saul didn't come in the morning. Because he had gone on the way back to take a little side trip and build an altar for himself. And Samuel stands and waits, and finally he comes. Saul's first words to Samuel, "The Lord bless you, I have carried out the Lord's instructions." Samuel says, "Then what is the bleating of the little cows and the mowing of the large cows that I hear? If that's what you've done," this NIV says the bleating of the sheep and the lowing of cattle, "what is that that I am hearing?" Saul didn't even blink an eye. The soldiers brought them back from Amalek. "They spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." They may look at that and think, well, they're going to kill them anyway. If what they're doing is going to offer them as a sacrifice, they're going to kill them anyway. Is that what God said to do? No. He didn't say, bring them back and offer them a sacrifice. He said, destroy them. And that's not what they did. They brought them back as a sacrifice. So we thought of a better idea than what God gave us. We thought of a better thing to do than what God told us to do. Sounds like the Garden of Eden. "Enough," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." "Tell me," Saul replied. "You were once small in your own eyes. Did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel." And he sent that key. "The Lord anointed you king over Israel. You were not king of Israel over Israel by your own doing. And you were not your king over Israel to do whatever you wish to do. The Lord anointed you as king over Israel to do the Lord's bidding. And he sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy these wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you wipe them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" "But I did obey the Lord. I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Now this we have got to get. Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. Idol worshippers offer sacrifices to their God for what purpose? So they can get what they want. So they can get blessed. So they can be protected. Our sacrifice is offered to God so you can come near him. But all the sacrifices in the world do not replace listening to him. And that's where he is. I can twist God any way I want to. I can make God happy if I just do the right things and I don't have to listen to him. Stubbornly religious. Making up his own rules for his religion. And not listening. Not listening to what God says. Then Saul said to Samuel, "I've sinned. I violated the Lord's command and your instructions. I was afraid of the men, and so I gave in to them." Here we start on a pattern. I have sinned, but it wasn't really me. I gave in to them. He doesn't own up to what he's done. Now I beg you, forgive my sin and come back with me so that I may worship the Lord. Now I beg you, forgive my sin and come on, go with me so I can worship the Lord. And everything will be all right. And Samuel says, I'm not going. I will not go back with you. You've rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. So Samuel turned around to walk away, and Saul grabs the hem of his garment, and it tears it off. And Samuel turns around and says to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you, and he's given it to your neighbor. He's given it to somebody better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a human being that he should change his mind. Then Saul said, I have sinned, but please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship the Lord your God. Whose honor is he seeking? The people. I'm afraid of what they'll think about me. I'm afraid of how they will look at me. So please, I have done wrong. Now please go with me so that I can worship God and the elders of my people and all the people of Israel will see that you still honor me. For some reason, Samuel goes. But before he goes, bring me the king of Agag. Agag comes in chains and he's smiling. He's cheerful because he thinks the agony of death has passed. And Samuel says to him, your sword has made women childless. So will your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hacked him into pieces. And Samuel never saw Saul again for as long as he lived. We have one more visit between the two. But he never saw him again for as long as he lived. And the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. So we're about to have a big transition. Because the next chapter, we meet David. And we're introduced to the better man. And we're introduced to the man after God's own heart. And we'll talk about David. Thank y'all. Have a good rest of the week. Don't shovel too much snow Friday night. And try to stay dry.